The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Kiritapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Oh, well, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, this morning Statistics New Zealand released GDP data for the March quarter, showing that the economy continues to grow solidly in the face of global headwinds.
Order.
While I would caution members from drawing too many conclusions from quarterly data, GDP grew 0.6% in the March quarter and 2.7% in the year to March, in line with Treasury and market forecasts. It's also particularly pleasing to see the contribution of the construction sector up 3.7%. In summary, Mr. Speaker, plenty to be cheerful about.
Supplementary, sir. How does the GDP data compare with international counterparts?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, this latest GDP data shows the New Zealand economy continues to outpace many of its international peers. Both in the March quarter and over the year, the New Zealand economy grew faster than Australia, Canada, the UK, the euro era and the OECD average. Mr. Speaker, today's data demonstrates the solid fundamentals and ongoing resilience of the New Zealand economy within the slowing and uncertain global economic environment.
Supplementary, sir. How is the government supporting the resilience of the New Zealand economy?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, so many ways. The Coalition Government has introduced a range of policies to support New Zealand's transition towards a more productive, sustainable and inclusive economy, including the Research and Development Tax Credit, reforms to our skills training system, investment in our regions through the Provincial Growth Fund and our record land transport infrastructure investment. Alongside this, Mr. Speaker, the government's books are being managed responsibly, delivering surpluses, managing debt and keeping expenses under control so that we are in a position to respond as the global economy slows.
Question number two, the Honourable Paula Bennett.
Thank you, sir. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government's statements, policies and actions?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes.
Supplementary, is reducing both the supply and demand of methamphetamine and other Class A drugs a priority for the government?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes.
Why then did Cabinet cancel $10 million a year that was going towards reducing the supply, use and harm caused by meth in our communities?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, on behalf of the Prime Minister, our priorities have been laid out clearly in front of the public and we're following them all, including having the firepower in men and women frontline in the police to do the job and 400 dedicated in particular to that purpose.
Did she read the Cabinet paper that rescinded the $10 million a year allocated by the previous National Government to reduce the supply, use and harm caused by meth?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes, but the question that was put to this Parliament by way of that questioner was that the government has not prioritised any more the matter of defeating the meth trade, and we have.
Why has her government shelved the meth action plan, which reduced adult meth use rates in New Zealand by 50%?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the fact is that the statement made by that member, is not correct. That is why we are seeking alternative measures, including having the frontline police firepower to do the job, and 400 in particular dedicated to that purpose.
Well, is she aware that the meth action plan did in fact work and it did halve the rate of adult meth use, as it was 2.1% in 2009 and halved to 0.9% in 2015, according to the Tackling Methamphetamine Indicators and Progress Report, October 2015, and has remained stable since then?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that claim is the world's best kept secret. If on becoming the government, the meth trade was defeated, why on earth would we devote so much time and so much money to get on top of it? And that is what the community has advised us to do.
So why was the meth action plan, which had a proven success rate at reducing the supply, use and the harm caused by meth in New Zealand, dropped by her government, and we have recently seen it increasing in our communities?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the claim that it was effective is simply not true. And every answer that's been given to that primary question the subsequent question has been dedicated to saying that. If it was successful, why was everybody out in the countryside, including the police, saying the thing was totally out of hand and we need new forces? That's why we found 400 dedicated police to do the job.
Order, Mr. Speaker. Point of order, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table the Tackling Methamphetamine Indicators and Progress Report, October 2015, which shows a 50% reduction over those 6 years.
And it's not already been published?
Well, it was given to me by my... it probably is published, but the member says he hasn't seen it. We probably typed some words into the search bar and up it came.
Order. The member knows two things. One, she should not attempt to table a document which is already published. She's an experienced member and she knows that well. And secondly, by way of point of order, subsequent point of order, she shouldn't trifle with the chair. I think we might just sort of leave it at that for now. Supplementary question, the Honourable Stuart Nash.
To the Acting Prime Minister, has he seen reports over the last 5 years of the previous government, police numbers actually dropped by 7, and yet under the first 18 months of this government, we have trained nearly 1,400 police to be sent out into our communities?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I rush to confirm that that is a fact. But here's the real point. If the meth trade was being successfully attacked by the previous administration, how come 500 kilograms appeared on a 90-mile beach, recall, and discovered, not by the then police because they didn't have the resources, no, discovered by a passerby, and that's why when we became the government, we decided to act.
Is she concerned that a clause in the Misuse of Drugs Amendment Bill, alongside a reduction in funding for reducing harm caused by meth, could lead to an increase in use and harm in our communities?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, and as confirmed by the Minister of Police, we are setting out with the appropriate resources to get on top of the scourge in our country. Make no bones about it. So I'd invite that member to reflect on the 90 Mile Beach and other events where nothing was happening against what is being done now by the government and the police in particular.
Supplementary.
Supplementary.
Well, Paula
Bennett. Supplementary. Does she believe that today's prosecution announcement will convince her Minister of Foreign Affairs that Russians were responsible for shooting down MH17?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I can answer that the Foreign Minister at the time expressed his serious desire to see the end of the inquiry in Holland or the Netherlands. That inquiry has now been complete and a prosecution is about to start. Now, unlike some people in this House, we wait to see the evidence be unveiled in court before we make up our opinion. But of course, this is a party over there that when Theresa May was announcing the day of an inquiry with respect to Salisbury was shouting out that they had a guilty party already. If that was the case, why did Theresa May announce an inquiry? Get some legal training.
Supplementary.
Certainly. Honourable Certainly.
The Acting Prime Minister, has she seen quotes from the Eastern District Police Commander which states that the new gang focus unit that's been set up in Easton is purely a result of the new recruits that this government has put out into our communities?
No, I'm going to interrupt that. The only link of that is police, and the whole line of questioning has been while it was a very general question. I think the member has sort of got outside of it. Further supplementary, Paula Bennett. Question number three, the Honourable Amy Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by all of the government's decisions, statements and actions in relation to his portfolio?
Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Yes, in the context in which they were made and undertaken.
Does he stand by his statement that, quote, we are going to transition away from an economy based on population growth, end quote, when ANZ has said this morning that today's GDP numbers show population growth is in fact very clearly the driver of our economic growth?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely yes, because 9 years of neglect takes more than 18 months to turn around, but we've made a pretty good start.
Why has growth per person halved under his watch from an average of 1.6% a year to now just 0.8% a year, making us the sixth worst in the OECD for population growth per person last year?
Speaker, the statistics New Zealand released today actually is 0.9%, not 0.8%. But in addition to that, Mr. Speaker, what I would say is that when you look at a more reasonable period of comparison, you would see the GDP per capita is forecast to be just a little bit below the 5-year average and just a little bit above the 10-year average over the forecast period.
Is he aware of comments from Westpac this morning that today's GDP figures were, quote, flattered by a 9.6% jump in mining that was led by a bout of exploration activity, which has now been abandoned?
Mr. Speaker, the mining numbers within GDP do move around a lot. But what I do note in terms of what Westpac said is that they said that growth to date has been steady in the face of mounting global risks, which is precisely what this government has been saying and why our underlying economic fundamentals being strong is so important.
The Right Honourable Winston
Peter. Can I ask the Minister of Finance, how can population growth be fueling the economic growth as being claimed here, when in terms of thousands it's gone from the 70s under the previous administration to the 50s now?
Well, indeed, and Mr. Speaker, that is true that in the latter part of last year, net migration numbers settled around the 50,000 level. We've had some changes to the way that's measured, but actually what this government is doing is moving towards more sustainable patterns of growth. That will take some time, but actually investing in the economy and skills and infrastructure and research and development is what we need to do to have a more productive economy. It's just a pity it didn't happen in the decade that that government was in office.
Doesn't he think he should show more concern for the underlying health of our economy when in the last quarter the services sector, which makes up 70% of the economy, grew an insipid 0.2%?
Mr. Speaker, it really is a testament around people's half glass full, half glass empty approach. Today, we could be celebrating that the construction sector expanded by 3.7% in this quarter. People with the confidence to build, but unfortunately, there are some on the other side of the House determined to be pessimistic, talk down the economy. It's almost like they need to fly someone in to make them cheerful.
Does he really think that him blaming international circumstances and refusing to take any responsibility or even acknowledge the weaknesses in our economy is going to be of any comfort to the real New Zealanders in the four sectors of our economy, including agriculture and retail, that went backwards over the last quarter?
Mr. Speaker, as I said in my answer to an earlier question, it is important to look at these figures on an annual basis. There always is movement within particular sectors on a quarter-by-quarter basis. But what I do know is on this side of the House, we actually have a plan to grow a productive, sustainable and inclusive economy, and we're very proud of that plan.
Question number four, the Honourable Ruth Dyson.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for Courts. What recent announcements has he made about settling long-standing insurance disputes following the Canterbury earthquakes?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, on Monday, along with the Minister for Greater Christchurch Regeneration, the Honourable Megan Woods, I launched the Canterbury Earthquakes Insurance Tribunal to be chaired by former District Court Judge Chris Somerville. That tribunal will give Canterbury homeowners a fair, flexible and cost-effective way to resolve their outstanding insurance claims relating to the 2010 and 2011 Canterbury earthquakes, including claims with Southern Response and the Earthquake Commission. This is great news for the tired and frustrated Canterbury homeowners who are still waiting, many of whom are still waiting, for a resolution to their insurance claims from those earthquakes.
Supplementary. What effect will the Canterbury Earthquakes Tribunal have on outstanding claimants?
Mr Speaker, the Tribunal will be homeowner-led and will be able to tailor its approach to the needs of each case. Referral to an independent funded mediation service will be one of the options available for resolving claims without the need for a formal hearing. But the Tribunal will also have the ability to do arbitral decisions and to award general damages and costs. There will be no fees for access to the Tribunal, and homeowners will not need a lawyer. Mr Speaker, the Tribunal will be a circuit breaker for those disputes that have dragged on for too long and provide homeowners with closure and the opportunity to move on with their lives.
How will this benefit Cantabrians?
Mr Speaker, there are still over 500 active earthquake list cases in the High Court, and over 250 of those were lodged in just the last year alone. So we know that these issues are still affecting Cantabrians. The delay to resolve residential insurance claims has had a significant effect on Cantabrians' wellbeing. They need another option to help them reach an outcome. The Canterbury Earthquakes Insurance Tribunal will go a long way to meeting this need.
Question number 5, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Housing and Urban Development, is the KiwiBuild program delivering good value for money for New Zealand taxpayers?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Yes, it is. The 10,356 contracted and committed affordable homes that KiwiBuild has or will enable are worth approximately $3.5 billion. In terms of costs, primarily the Crown has bought $196 million of land to build homes on, including at the Unitech campus in Auckland and the Wakatipu High School site in Queenstown.
Is he aware that budget documents show that in total, over the 3 years of this government, $48 million will be spent on the KiwiBuild unit and KiwiBuild operations at the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development?
Well, I'm aware that the estimates show $21 million will have been spent on the administration of the KiwiBuild program from the time that the government took office through to 30th of June 2019. That's primarily spent on due diligence for land acquisition and commercial negotiations. For example, engineers being contracted to assess whether housing can be built on Crown land, infrastructure and planning assessments, legal advice on development agreements, and planning and RMA advice and applications.
No, the Minister will have another crack at actually answering the question that was asked. Does the member want it repeated?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Is he aware that budget documents show that in total, over the 3 years of this government, $48 million will be spent on the KiwiBuild unit and KiwiBuild operations at the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development?
Yes, I am aware of that, but I'm also aware that the estimates show that in the period to date, $21 million has been spent on administration of the program, primarily on due diligence for development and construction work.
Is he also aware that if he is able to deliver the 1,600 houses he has forecast by July next year, that that will equate to a spend on overheads for bureaucrats of $30,000 per house delivered?
Based on the members' premises, the maths might be correct, but it's also true to say that KiwiBuild has enabled over $150 worth of affordable homes for every dollar spent so far on the administration of the program. A 150-to-1 benefit cost ratio at the beginning of a 10-year program is pretty darn good.
Paul Eagle. How does the value of the homes enabled by KiwiBuild compare to the administration costs of the program?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. KiwiBuild has enabled more than $150 worth of affordable homes for every dollar spent so far on the administration of the program. We've acknowledged that KiwiBuild hasn't ramped up as fast as we planned and that the fixed costs of the program will be higher because of this. But the early results do show that the model has the potential to enable a great number of affordable homes for a relatively modest investment.
If it is ramping up, then how many houses per year does the KiwiBuild policy aim to deliver?
Well, I've made it very clear to the member that we're not setting any interim targets. But I will say this to the member. No matter how far short we might fall from our early targets for that program, we will have done a lot more than the previous government even attempted to do.
Paul Eagle.
What sites has the Crown purchased so far in the program?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the $196 million has been invested in acquiring land for housing across New Zealand, dozens of different projects, the largest of which are Unitec, where more than 3,000 state KiwiBuild and market homes will be built in Auckland, and 300 homes, many of them affordable, at the Wakatipu site in Queenstown. But you did nothing about it.
We sure did. Order. Dr. Smith, can we let the Honourable Mrs. Collins ask the question? Thank you. Judith Collins.
How many houses will the $48 million spent on the operation of the KiwiBuild program deliver?
Well, the $21 million that have been spent so far out of the projected 48 for the three-year period have enabled 10,356 affordable KiwiBuild homes to be worth approximately $3.5 billion.
Does he agree with Phil Twyford MP, who has previously said that people can't live in a pipeline?
Well, but people can live in homes that are contracted and committed and will be built.
Question number six, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does he stand by all his statements, policies and actions?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Yes, in the context they were said and done.
Does he stand by his statement this morning in Select Committee that New Zealand had over-invested in roads and motorways for decades?
Yes, actually, because particularly in the last decade, the former government spent 40% of the transport budget on a handful of urban state highway projects that carried only 4% of vehicle journeys.
So does he think people crawling along winding and dangerous single-lane road from Katikati to Tauranga, for example, a rapidly growing part of the country and a primary route between Auckland and Tauranga,
order,
will agree question. That we've over-invested in roads?
A point of order, the Right Honourable Winston Peter.
Speaker, there's no such single-lane road between Katikati and Tauranga.
Well, order that. I'm not familiar with the area, but it's not, and I'm absolutely certain the member is, but I think that is the level of detail of question which, if that member is correct, the Minister will be absolutely capable of refuting as part of his answer.
The Honourable Phil Twyford. Well, like so many people in communities all up and down this country who saw their family and friends dying on rural and neglected roads, they will feel frustrated that for 9 years the former government poured money into a handful of urban motorway projects and did nothing to improve projects like the one, roads like the one that the member raises.
Does he really think somebody crawling along Auckland's southern motorway on sections 2 lanes wide each way, as they have been since the 1960s, will agree with him that we've over-invested in motorways?
Well, I think most Aucklanders, except for that member, understands that Auckland's long-term congestion problems can only be solved by building integrated modern transport systems that include not only motorways and roads, but rapid transit, public transport and walking and cycling. And that is the policy of this government.
Does he accept that public transport will work for some people, for some of the trips they need to make, but the vast majority of people still want to use cars on roads?
Yes.
For a host of good reasons.
Order. I've got a slight sort of problem in that the bit at the end was not part of a question at all. We will go back to the Minister and ask the bit other than the addition which he interrupted. Phil Twyford.
Yes, but as the incredibly successful Northern Busway shows, when you provide modern, affordable, convenient, reliable public transport for people, even a small percentage of people will choose to leave the car at home at peak hour, take the rapid transit bus or the train, and that allows the roads to move more freely for everybody else who has to drive.
Supplementary, if you believe...
Aucklanders have confidence in the Auckland rail network when KiwiRail consistently fails Aucklanders with multiple rail shutdowns, and what's he doing about it?
Well, I would point out to the member that yesterday's shutdown, which happened during the morning peak, was, I'm advised, caused by a contractor who snipped a cable inadvertently, causing a signalling failure. I've spoken with the Chief Executive of KiwiRail and said that the government expects KiwiRail will do everything possible to ensure trouble-free and reliable service on the Auckland public transport system. But what these 2 days show, the interruptions of travel during peak hour, is that no city, particularly Auckland, can function properly at peak hour without a reliable public transport system that allows thousands and thousands of people to get to and from work without having to clog up the motorways.
Supplementary, if he believes we've over-invested in roads, is that why he and Julianne Genter are determined to build no new ones?
We are the party of a balanced transport policy. We believe in both roads and motorways, public transport and walking and cycling. Cities all over the world are pursuing these policies, except for the National Party, who are stuck in the 1950s and believe that everybody can drive their car to work and no one needs to take public transport. And I say to the member, those days are gone. Move on.
Paul Goldsmith.
Does he accept that the previous National Government invested considerable sums in public transport, such as through the City Rail Loop in Auckland and many other examples, as well as investing in roads? And it's possible to do both.
I note that the former government delayed the Auckland City Rail Link by 6 years before they were finally embarrassed into supporting the project, and I challenge the member to name one other single bit of transport and public transport infrastructure in Auckland during those 9 years.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
My question, in light of that question about the City Rail Link, can the Minister confirm that the original costings done under the previous government for the City Rail Link had no ability to take account of cost escalation, and that's now having to be dealt with by this government?
Yes, I'll say to the member that one of the big allocations or appropriations in Budget 2019 was making up for the fact that the former government did not provide sufficient contingency or inflation proofing for the biggest transport infrastructure project this country has ever seen.
A point of order there.
I seek leave to table some information obtained from CRLL which shows the government is blocking the breakdown of the cost blowout of the CRLL.
How did the member get it? What's the source? Is it from a website?
It's from the Official Information Act, so it's not public information.
Is there any objection to the information CRL being tabled without all the other extra bits added on? Is there any objection to that? There appears to be none. It may be tabled.
Supplementary.
Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does he stand by his statement that the Melling Interchange project ticks all the boxes? And if so, why has funding for the project been delayed until 2028 or later?
Well, I reject the premise of the member's question that it's been delayed. Under the former government, the Melling project wasn't due to happen for another decade. Our government has looked at it closely. NZTA has approved the project. It's said that it's got a detailed business case underway, and all it's required is for funding to be made available, and NZTA is talking directly with the council about making that happen.
Chris Hipkins, Honourable Chris Hipkins, because I think it's probably related.
That is indeed, Mr. Speaker. A supplementary question to the Minister. So can he confirm that despite any pre-election promises that were made, no funding was allocated to the Melling Interchange project, and it was not going to be allocated for at least another 10 years?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is in fact a correct telling of the history of the Melling project. It was one of a number of unfunded election campaign promises, and that's all they were.
Before I go to any supplementary or any points of order, I want to ask Mr. Bishop whether he then made an unparliamentary interjection.
I don't think so, Mr. Speaker.
Well, if a member indicated that the minister making a comment was saying something he knew was untrue, it is exceptionally unparliamentary.
Oh, yes, I did make it.
Well, the member will withdraw and apologise.
Yeah, I'll withdraw and apologise.
And I'll warn the member, if he does that again, he has been round here for a long time, he knows what the rules are, and to pretend that he did not know what he said was out of order just doesn't wash it with me.
Supplementary.
The Honourable James Shaw.
Would the Minister agree that if we were to do as the Opposition is proposing and double the number of lanes every few decades, for example, from 2 each way in Auckland to 4 each way, then a few decades from now we would be doubling them from 4 each way to 8 each way, then from 8 each way to 16 each way, then from 16 each way to 32 each way, and in that scenario, what would happen to land prices?
Well, the member asks a very good question. The sheer amount of land that would be wasted adding more and more lanes to the motorway network doesn't even bear thinking about.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can the Minister confirm that with respect to the Warkworth, our Pūhoi to Warkworth Highway, which is taking 12 years, on that basis, the so-called promise but unfunded Warkworth to Whangarei Highway would take another 68 years.
I think the member's calculations are absolutely right. And what's more, that stretch of highway that the National Party promised in the last election between Warkworth and Whangarei would cost $5 billion. And at the time, before the last election, the then Transport Minister, Simon Bridges, was advised that those promises would have required an extra 8 cents a litre fuel excise duty.
Question number 7, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Police. What recent announcements has he made about the firearms buyback scheme?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr. Speaker, today I announced the details of the government's compensation scheme for the buyback of prohibited firearms. The buyback scheme starts today and runs for 6 months to the 20th of December. The buyback and amnesty has one objective: to remove the most dangerous weapons from circulation following the loss of life at Al Noor and Linwood mosques on the 15th of March. The buyback scheme recognises licensed firearms owners are now in possession of prohibited items through no fault of their own, but because a law was passed by almost the entire Parliament. I believe we have struck a fair balance, and I would like to thank the New Zealand Police for their valuable and significant policy and operational work to get this historical scheme underway and managed safely over the next 6 months. My hope is that other members will also be supportive of the police's efforts in their communities.
What are the key elements of the buyback scheme?
Mr. Speaker, the key elements of the buyback scheme include The price will reflect the brand, make and model of the prohibited firearm at either 95%, 70% or 25% of its base price, depending upon the condition of the firearm. The compensation for prohibited parts and magazines will either be 70 or 25% of its base price, depending upon their condition. Dealers will be compensated for stock, and approved dealers will help police with the collection and buyback process. Owners of some prohibited firearms will also have the option to have them modified by approved gunsmiths to make them lawful, which costs up to $300 to be met by the Crown. And police will also have the ability to determine the amount of compensation for unique or rare prohibited items. Police want to work closely with owners of prohibited items to help them comply with the law and have detailed plans in place for the collection of firearms from the community.
Will there be sufficient funding for the buyback scheme under Vote Police?
Mr. Speaker, one of the underlying issues we have been dealing with in relation to the buyback scheme is the uncertainty around the number of prohibited firearms in our country. The budget set aside $168 million for the buyback scheme on the 30th of May. The fund has also been increased by an additional $40 million through a contribution from ACC. The total set aside for the scheme is now over $200 million. We will get a clearer picture as the buyback scheme gets underway, but as the Minister of Finance said on budget night, if we need to top up the funding, we will.
Question number 8, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. How is the well-being of cancer patients in New Zealand affected by the government's policies and actions in health?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, the well-being budget will help New Zealanders avoid, treat, live with or recover from cancer in many, many ways. We are extending the National Bowel Screening Program across another 4 DHBs, an investment of $36 million in detecting an all-too-common cancer. The $2.8 billion uplift in funding for our DHBs will sustain the prevention, screening, diagnosis and cancer treatment services that New Zealanders deserve. We're moving to make those services better and more consistent through our new Cancer Action Plan. In Budget 2019, we also set aside $1.7 billion in capital spending, possibly the largest allocation in health capital ever, some of which will support better and more advanced cancer treatment. And let's not forget the terrible toll a cancer diagnosis can have on people and families. The wellbeing budget recognises this reality through a massive expansion in access to primary mental health services. Of course, there are many other ways in which this government is working to better support cancer care, but that is a good start for the members' benefit.
Speaking of families, has he seen a report of cancer patient Susie Wall-Cade telling the Health Select Committee of her self-funding Kadzyla, quote, "There goes my KiwiSaver, there goes my retirement, sorry my husband, sorry my family, no holiday, sorry my friends, we can't afford to go out for dinner with you," end quote. And what is his assessment of her well-being?
Mr. Speaker, of course, it is impossible not to have deep empathy for people facing a difficult diagnosis with cancer. My heart goes out to those families. The prior government obviously did not progress any work on early access schemes for those drugs. It is a complex policy area, but this government is determined to look more closely there. The Prime Minister has asked me to accelerate work on early access, and that is exactly what is happening. I'd also note that we have put aside further money in the current budget to ensure that Pharmac has more money across the drug buying spectrum and is now close to a record $1 billion.
Has he seen a report of cancer patient Claudine Johnson saying, quote, "The wellbeing budget came out on the day that I had my first treatment in Australia. So on the day that Australia was giving this Kiwi a chance to live longer, New Zealand was saying people like me don't matter," end quote. And what is his assessment of her wellbeing?
Mr. Speaker, I know the situation, something of the situation. I've met Claudine Johnson, and I know these things are very, very difficult. Mr. Speaker, we also in this budget, I would note, have put aside $4 billion for health. A lot of what we are tackling in health is the result of years and years and years of underfunding in the health system. This government is committed to improving the health services available to New Zealanders. Unfortunately, it will take more than one or two budgets to address those 9 long years of neglect under the previous government.
Order. Before I ask the member to go on, this is a serious matter, and I think has generally been, you know, while people have discussions about the style of questions, I think when the minister is answering, he doesn't need support of the sort that he is getting from my right at the moment. I think let's just take this issue seriously. Michael Woodhouse.
Has he seen a report of Mrs. Johnson's 8-year-old daughter Lucy telling her Australian classmates, quote, "My dad talked to a man called David Clark. He promised that if he was in government, he would make cancer care in Aotearoa better. But he lied," end quote. And what is his assessment of Lucy's well-being?
Mr. Speaker, these are incredibly difficult and sensitive matters that affect and disrupt families who are facing death of a loved one. And I am, of course, deeply concerned to hear about Lucy's well-being, Mr. Speaker. But we on this side of the House are taking it seriously. We are taking steps that the previous government did not, and I think they should have a good, hard, long look at themselves on that side of the House.
If I can do that.
Whose well-being is more important, the Johnson family's or the minister's, who was reported to have had his feelings hurt by the Johnstons speaking out?
Mr. Speaker, I do regret that member trying to trivialise this issue. This is a serious issue for a family that is facing devastating consequences, including failures under his government's watch.
Mr. Speaker.
Tamati Coffey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Whānau Order and reads, what recent announcements has he made about Whānau Order?
The Honourable Pene Hanare.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. On 30 June 2019, I announced the total funding package for Whānau Order of $116 million. This includes funding of $80 million to expand the coverage and impact of Whānau Order, $35 million to introduce the Whānau Order approach in the correction system, supporting Māori under 30 and their whānau before, during and after incarceration, and $1 million to research the success of applying a whānau-centred approach to primary health care.
What is his vision for Whānau Order?
Mr. Speaker, our vision for Whānau Order is that Whānau Order is the whānau-centred approach to be integrated into government policies, programs and services across government to improve the well-being of all New Zealanders. This includes ensuring Whānau Order is adequately resourced to support whānau to achieve their aspirations, is appropriately supported across government agencies, and whānau are able to play a key role in decision-making for their aspirations.
How is he planning to grow Whānau Order and whānau-centred approaches across government?
Mr. Speaker, a key challenge set for this team is to work across agencies with senior leaders to look beyond existing strategic, policy and financial constraints to explore new ways of designing and delivering services in a whānau-centred way. To date, there has been considerable interest in the development of whānau-centred policy across government and how it can support the government's priority areas. We will continue to work closely with ministerial colleagues to promote collective investment in whānau order and the broader adoption of whānau-centred practices in government agencies.
Question number 10, Mark Patterson.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Internal Affairs. What recent announcements has she made regarding recognition of Fire and Emergency New Zealand volunteers?
Mr. Speaker, on Monday I announced a $4 million a year package to recognise the contribution made by Fire and Emergency New Zealand volunteers to their communities across New Zealand. These volunteers get out of bed in all weather, put down their knives and forks at the family dinner table and leave their paid employment in order to serve their community. The package recognises not only their contributions but the support given to them by their families and employers. The package includes an annual contribution to out-of-pocket expenses of $300 and a whānau support payment of $50 per night for when they have to travel away from home for formal training.
What other announcements has she made to support our volunteer firefighters?
Mr. Speaker, on the 8th of June, I was in Southland to open the new Thornbury Volunteer Fire Station. This new station is a prototype station that will be tested to assess whether it can be used as a design in other communities. In order to keep our community safe, volunteer firefighters and smaller rural fire stations like this one need to have the right facilities, tools and technology. This is especially the case for communities like Thornbury, where it is the only 24-hour emergency service.
Why is it important to recognise fire and emergency volunteers?
Mr. Speaker, volunteers play a crucial role in keeping people safe. Fire and Emergency New Zealand has 11,800 volunteers. They make up around 80% of the organisation. Volunteers attend thousands of incidents each year, not just fires, but motor vehicle accidents and medical emergencies. They save lives. Our communities are stronger because of them, and we thank them.
Question number 11, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr. Speaker, question to the Associate Minister of Education. How many of the 600 learning support coordinators she promised does she estimate will be working in schools by the beginning of Term 1 of the 2020 school year?
Mr. Speaker, I expect to announce the allocation of the first tranche of approximately 600 full-time learning support coordinator roles to schools in Kura by August, in time for those schools to include the new role in their staffing orders. Schools and Kura receiving a learning support coordinator through the first tranche can then begin recruitment processes as coordinators will be employed by schools. Our goal is to have as many as the possible 600 full-time teaching equivalent learning support coordinator roles in place by Term 1 of the 2020 school year.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. Will she absolutely guarantee that there will be 600 new learning support coordinators in schools by Term 1 of 2020?
Mr. Speaker, what I can absolutely guarantee is that the funding is available for 600, and it could actually be over 600, depending on the final pay scale that role will be at. So that funding will be available for those people to be employed by the first term of 2020. It will be up to the boards of trustees of the schools that receive the allocation to go about employing those people.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. When she said in November 2018, today's announcement is designed to allow schools as much time as possible to prepare for the new role, did she anticipate 8 months later schools would have no final decisions about the role?
Mr. Speaker, yes, actually. Part of the reason why to make the announcement when we did was also to make sure that the learning support delivery model that needed to be intricately part of what is the learning support coordinators to change and deliver support, learning support as quickly and as close to the ground for our students needed to also be rolled out by the Ministry of Education. That is what has been going on parallel to the development of the job description and the allocation process for schools. Schools, we've also had 5 peak bodies, and at least 20 schools have been part of the development of the job description. So the months that the member is talking about have not been sitting idle. We've been working with the sector to make sure we get this right as fast as possible.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
To the Associate Minister, can she confirm that one of the biggest constraints to recruiting and employing learning support coordinators is the critical shortage of teachers that this government inherited when we took office?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I can confirm that is expected to be one of the restraints. However, I believe in conversations that I have had with principals and members of the sector and teachers who've actually left the sector, there are those among that workforce who may have left the classroom due to the pressures of the last 9 years who are still passionate about working with young people and children with learning needs. And this may be one of those roles that bring them back inside our schools to support those young people.
Mr. Speaker, supplementary question. How many children with complex needs are helped when she blames Nationals and fails to recognise she's had 18 months with the ministerial warrant?
Mr. Speaker, obviously nobody is supported when this House decides to bicker over what are the learning support needs that should be delivered for our children. So in the times that I'm not here answering questions from that member, I spend it working to make sure we can deliver for children.
Because supplementary question.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
So we might know what the resource situation is. How long does it take to train a teacher?
Depending on whether it is a primary or a secondary teacher, sir, it can take between 3 to 4 years.
Richard, question. How can she defend that after 8 months later, after promises from the Prime Minister and herself, there's no job description, there's real concerns about filling the role, there's no clarity on
order,
what schools will get
question.
Them?
Supplementary, I have no problem at all defending it, because in the 8 months that we have been working on this, we have been working with the sector. Probably one of the failings of the previous government was they decided they knew best and they never spoke to the sector. We have designed the job description with 5 peak bodies, at least 20 schools. We have been running models of the learning support delivery model across the country to make sure that when we do something, it actually works.
Order.
A point of order, the Honourable Nikki.
I seek leave to table Ministry of Education document, New Learning Support Delivery Model. It's not public.
It's not public.
It's been provided to some individual schools, but there's the whole point of this question is a whole lot of schools don't know what's happening with the role.
Speaking to the point of order? Speaking to the point of order.
Well, it's not really it's a new point of order while I'm considering whether it can be tabled. We'll go that way, shall we?
Just for your information, Mr. Speaker, the learning support delivery model has been a topic of a video that has been up on Facebook explaining to every piece of the sector how it works and to the public of New Zealand. The drawing of the delivery model is also available in many places.
Mr. Speaker?
If the member is going to tell me that that is not true and she has a document which is not generally available, then I will put the question. But in doing so, I want to give her a warning that if she is not accurate in that description, that will be a serious misleading of the House.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. I seek leave to table an email from the Ministry of Education that has these documents attached but has additional information, which is not in the public domain, widely, around the ratio of schools that will have access to these roles.
Is there any objection to that document being tabled? There appears to be none. Question number 12, Andrew Bailey.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Revenue. What concerns, if any, does he have regarding the operation of the latest phase rollout of the IRD Business Transformation Program, especially in relation to KiwiSaver Pi tax arrangements?
Speaker, none.
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Oh, good. How much money is owed to people who have overpaid Pi tax on their KiwiSaver and other investment income, and will this be repaid?
Mr. Speaker, no money is owed. The Pi rate is the final rate of taxation.
Is the new IRD system capable of making refunds to those people who have paid too much tax on their investment incomes?
Mr. Speaker, the new IRD system will be capable of making refunds to those people who have overpaid or underpaid their tax.
Dr. Deborah Russell.
What reports has he seen about how the new IRD system is working following the latest rollout of the Business Transformation Program?
Good news, Mr. Speaker. I can inform the House that as of the 18th of June, over $313 million has been automatically refunded to taxpayers with an average refund of $432. Recent reports also indicate that the compliance cost savings for SMEs as a result of the changes continue to track ahead of predictions. NZIER noted that research and feedback, quote, seems to suggest IRD has made significant inroads into reducing tax-related compliance costs, end quote. Inland Revenue continues to work with tax agents to resolve some of the issues that have arisen as a result of the huge rollout.
Mr. Speaker, how can it be that 950,000 people who have overpaid tax on their investment income will not receive a refund when the new system is capable of making such payments?
Mr. Speaker, in answers to that member at FEC, the Commissioner advised that due to the significant amount of operational resource, she made a decision it is better to move forward and help people get this right moving forward.
I want to thank the Minister for my 75 cents.
Well done.
Point of order.
A point of order.
Is the member finished?
I am for the question.
Sorry, no, it's not a question, it's a point of order. So the member has finished his supplementaries? Well, where you go? Ask it now, please.
Why did he not change the tax legislation when he had the opportunity to do so this week in the House to enable the ARD to make these refunds?
Mr Speaker, I'll just reiterate, in answer to that member at FEC, the Commissioner who is responsible for the IRD, the operational management of the IRD, advised that due to a significant amount of operational resource, she made a decision it is better to move forward and help people get this right moving into the future.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honour. That concludes oral questions.